Hello, my name is Poe Johnson. I'm here at Creative Disturbances. I'm a third-year PhD student, and I'm here with Sean B. Carroll. Can you describe your background for us, please?
I've been a working biologist for over 30 years, but I spent a lot of time communicating science to the public in various ways, as an author, as a producer of films, and as a public speaker.
So when you're trying to convey, and I think this is very important for people to understand, is that when you're trying to convey information about your science to the masses, what is the sort of responsibility of the public intellectual, and particularly in this particular moment with science being treated the way it is, at least in America?
Well, I don't think it's the responsibility of everybody who does science to try to, you know, reach out. I think that many of us are educators anyway. Many of us are at universities and colleges. And so it's part of our regular day job to talk to hundreds of students and things like that. And that does give you some sense of what people are curious about and what they do and don't know. So for many of us, we can call upon that experience as teachers, whether we're flying on an airplane or sitting on a bus or sitting in a restaurant and or talking to our neighbors, and give some sense of what we're up to and why. So I don't think everyone's responsible for that, but a lot of us can participate in it. I think those of us that are have more experience at it, maybe are more inspired to do it, you know, we just have to seek out some opportunities to do it. And mainly what you're trying to do to people is sort of demystify science, that it's not, you know, some incredibly mysterious thing done by a tiny number of people, but it has a real sort of simple ingredients to the whole practice of science.
So when you're talking to students or when you're public speaking or when you're writing, what is it the idea that you're trying to convey to people about science itself? Is it just trying to explain it in the simplest way, maybe simple isn't the right word for it, but the clearest way possible for them to get the message? Or are you also trying to convey something else about science?
I think I'm just trying to first get them on the same page that they know what the question is. In other words, what could be interesting? So for example, if you're, you know, if you see a nature program or you happen to visit a national park and you understand that there's lots of animals that are grazers, right? Mm-hmm. And your best shot is to see deer or elk or something like that. And then, you know, the grizzly bear is the elusive thing or the mountain lion is the elusive thing. Well, why would that be? Why would there be so many more grazers and so few predators or something like that? You know, try to relate something to people's experiences and say, well, scientists ask these questions. Why do they ask this question? For a hobby? No, because it turns out that the number of predators on a landscape is really important to sort of the health of the whole landscape. And somebody might ask, well, really, why? How do we know that? And I can start to tell you a story. So I think the main thing is to sort of reach your audience where they are. Mm-hmm. I'm not sort of assume that you're going to be in my, you know, goodness knows, you don't want to be inside my head. It's a mess. You want to go to your audience where they are. And if it's six-year-old school kids, they have a certain grasp of the world. If it's, you know, 70-year-old retirees, they have a certain life experiences to call upon. But I think no matter what you're doing in communication, you have to kind of go to your audience where they are.
So do you think, to sort of push back a little against that, part of what's going on in America seemingly is that people don't have an understanding of the story of, say, like evolution or global warming. So do you think that this is dependent upon scientists then to explain it better, or is it just people aren't willing to listen?
Well, I think you've touched on a huge area, and you're both of what you said is right. It's willingness to listen varies. Can scientists explain it better? And of course, mostly we're explaining through the intermediary, which is the media. Mm-hmm. And the media has its own sort of rules of engagement, namely, for example, presenting two points of view.
Yes.
But when presenting two points of view, it's really hard for the media to convey the relative weight between those two points of view. And it's more dramatic, you know, on a news program or, you know, especially in sort of the cable news format we now have, you know, to have a scientist and somebody who disagrees with them square off, mm-hmm. you know, for 6 or 8 minutes. I don't think the audience is enlightened, but it seems to be a habit that we've gotten into. So it's, you know, I think that as much as, you know, I think a free press is really important to getting these ideas out, some of the practices in the media have to be thought about a little bit, because how do we deal with overwhelming consensus versus skepticism? And we struggle with these things in the areas you just mentioned.
So what do you think might be the way out of this, like, Thunderdome trap, right? So like two men enter, one man leaves. Like, how can we remove that kind of idea where if there's something that's overwhelmingly believed by scientists to be true, accepting that there's a small contingent who may not even be scientists at all who think differently. How do we get out of that?
I'll give you one example, and it comes from a both experience, positive and negative. Take a matter like evolution. I don't really think that an evolutionary biologist is going to help people whose concerns about evolution, say, for example, may come from a faith perspective. But there are plenty of clergy who are capable of discussing the meaning of evolution and while addressing people's concerns about faith. I have begged television producers to put these people on camera. I have given them names, contact numbers, the whole thing. In forums that I've been part of, I've recruited these people to participate, and they really speak to the audience's concerns. So some of the responsibility is for the media is to find people who can actually move their audience forward. And it's, you know, the last person who should be talking about people's faith concerns would be a scientist. Mm-hmm. And the last thing who should be talking about the validity of certain body of science is, you know, some clergy person. Yes. It should be somebody who can sort of address both perspectives in a constructive way. And we've gotten away from sort of constructive dialogue into more of this, a debate format, point, counterpoint, opposed to where are most people at on something. And I think it actually paints a picture that things are more polarized than they really are.
Yes. So do you think, though, that idea, the sort of point, counterpoint, where do you think this comes from? So is it found in the media, or does this media sort of like representing some idea? I think there has been this thought, and media has sort of like perpetuated this for a long time, sort of like, we're going to put these two opposing figures on screen. So this is going back to like Khrushchev, Nixon in some ways, right?
Yeah.
So like, we're going to put them and they're going to talk about their issues, and one person will be the right person.
I think when both views being represented are legitimate, this might be a decent way to have a conversation, and you have people who represent different points of view. Where it breaks down in science is when one side's not legitimate, right? So, and I think at this stage, it's just laziness. I hate to say it. I think it's we have become so used to this, no matter what's being discussed. And, you know, look at this. The whole red, blue, left, right sort of situation in the United States has really become more polarized than I think it was 30 or 35 years ago.
Seemingly, yes.
And, you know, it would take people wiser than I to sort of unpack how we got there. But it's not helping for, I think, where the majority sits is usually in the middle between these extremes. They want to have a reasoned discussion. They want to think about these things in constructive ways. They don't want to hear the tired old cliches of partisan, you know, polarized points of views. And people are going to shut off. So they might be entertained a little bit for the Thunderdome aspect. Mm-hmm. But they're shutting off to the substance of the discussion. Yeah. And that's going to cost us in the long run.
So do you think, and this goes back to what you said earlier when you said that you've been producer of movies, what are some of the movies that you've produced? And do you think that's perhaps a way to get to people and where they are, so to speak, like you said, so you can give them the information that they need to understand about science without it being someone sort of lecturing them, or they're getting this sort of faux debate between these two sides that are not really evenly matched?
Right. So I launched a documentary filmmaking initiative at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, where I'm head of science education. And last year, three different programs hit the air. One was a three-part series on evolution called Your Inner Fish on PBS. One was a one-hour show on vaccines, another pretty touchy topic, and the reemergence of vaccine-preventable diseases. And the third was on mass extinction and asking a question of, based on what we know in the past, where are we really today in terms of the threat of extinguishing lots of species? So, the recipe for those programs, and I'm only the executive overseeing these things. I'm not the filmmakers that are doing the really hard and creative work. But, you know, you try to assemble the best scientific information you have. You try in the stories to bring people into this. That was especially true in things like the vaccine film. And hopefully audiences can relate to the questions being asked and to the people who are asking and participating in the film. But there's a second dimension to this effort. And I think it's just a fact that younger generations are still forming their ideas. Mm-hmm. And really, if you give me an option between, you know, debating a 50-year-old and educating a 10-year-old, I will take the 10-year-old all day long. So we've been involved in making lots and lots of films and other sorts of media for use in the classroom. trying to tell really engaging stories, take kids to parts of the world they have never and may never see, walk in the shoes of scientists, see how we know what we know. And I'm pretty optimistic about having raised kids. I'm pretty optimistic about the ability of kids to sort out what we know and what we don't know, or sort out what we know and what's made up. And in the long run, you know, every social movement that's happened in the last 60 or 70 years in this country, you know, young people are on the forefront of it.
Absolutely.
So I think if we want change over the longer run, you got to really emphasize, you know, the next generations. And that's a big part of my effort.
So it's funny that you mentioned being an optimist about this, because I am like a diehard skeptic, right? I'm a cynic. I think we're lost. So is there a way to educate 10-year-olds now when you have their parents? If we sort of go with like the anti-vaccine people, for instance, like, is there a way it's such a powerful message, which is completely sort of like has no basis in anything, but they're so seemingly so loud and so vocal. How can we combat this? How can the people who want to see the world get better do something about that when so many people are like, no, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong.
Well, did you rebel against your parents?
Yes, yeah. But people always come back. Sociologically speaking, people always sort of like revert back to their parents over time.
Well, they might. But if I look out there and I think what's changed, you know, we didn't have environmental policy in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. The women's movement, the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement. These are some pretty seismic changes in society. Now, we all think everything took too long, and many of these things are far from done.
Yes.
But they started. And I think that the energy for carrying them on is generally with the younger generations. And so that's where I get my optimism, is that I think, for example, this generation, which, when I talk about this generation, let's just talk about Americans under 30, more diverse than ever, mm-hmm. Okay? I think a stronger sense of social justice. I think a sense of that it's up to them to make a more fair world and a more fair country. I think these are strong ideas running through the younger generations, and I think they will make their mark by seeking a more just, more fair, hopefully more enlightened, more evidence-based society. That's why I have to be optimistic. I the needle moves slowly. More slowly than all of us would like, but I think the needle is moving. And I, you know, I'm old enough to have seen some, you know, that if I now take before and after pictures on, not on a yearly basis, but on a 10 or 20 or 30 year basis, I've seen some needles move. And really with all, you know, you have to think what's worth trying in life. You know, there's no guarantee that, you know, one's efforts are going to amount to anything and that we might not slide backwards. But I think of the people that I really admire, wherever they have been in the world, not trying wasn't an option, right? I think that you know, you're not guaranteed a success. You're not guaranteed of, you know, victory or justice or whatever it might be. But standing by isn't an option. So I think the more people that just feel that trying is the important thing to do, the more we'll see improvement in things that matter to the most of us.
Well, I think that's really noble. I would wonder, so is it possible that that's sort of like it becomes like Sisyphus, like you're sort of like you're trying to push this boulder over a hill that you can't get to? And I'm reminded by the quote of the person I can't remember. So if like you, if you're a socialist and you're under 30, if you're not a socialist and you're under 30, you have no heart. But if you're not a capitalist and you're over 40, you have no brain, right? So like eventually my concern for all of these things is like, yes, I agree that social movements are important and they are all, the energy comes from the youth, but the youth eventually becomes like the dominant culture, right? They become the status quo. And is there a way to sort of like interject these things? So at least basic things like vaccinations, like there shouldn't be no reason why the whooping cough is killing kids.
Yeah.
That's the type of stuff that shouldn't happen anymore. So is there a way to like indoctrinate them? I guess that's the right term. So that doesn't happen anymore.
Well, I'm not sure, because maybe some of these things, you know, the things like whooping cough are a matter of backsliding. Mm-hmm. It is a matter of going backwards. And part of that is because a fair amount of people have no memory of these diseases, and now they're back. You know, maybe some people don't remember how hard people fought for the rights of various groups in this society and have become more blasé about it. So there may be some backsliding. So I think, yes, you have to. And this is one thing we did in the program, which is to remind people of the enormous numbers of people that were impacted by these diseases and the threat that they will come back. And why would we let that happen on our watch? So I think that, you know, while those sorts of things look like, you know, we've lost some of the progress that we've made, I think that's sort of the natural, unfortunately, that's sort of the natural unfolding of movements is, or natural unfolding even of scientific progress. You know, many people don't know why we would be in space these days, right? When, of course, going out into space so changed the nature of life on this planet, and I think, you know, many, many positive ways. But it doesn't seem apparent to many people right now why would we be spending any time in space? So some people can learn perspective, and we simply just have to sort of
plow through, keep on.
Keep on plugging like Sisyphus. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's why I think some of the wisdom of past generations, they faced much bigger obstacles. If I had to choose between, you know, trying to persuade a reluctant neighbor and living under the Nazi occupation, I'm gonna just try to persuade my reluctant neighbors. You know, we've been through some really terrible things in the past and made it. I think we can conquer some of these things.
I think that's a great place to end. I want to thank Sean B. Curl once again for joining us today. Once again, my name is Poa Johnson. Thank you and have a good day.